God has given me so much in your love. I felt like there was a message for me here in this story of this woman who learned that her own plan was not always the best plan. With the smell of vomit lingering in the air, I felt like I was going to burst with gratitude for this beautiful dream I was living, not in spite of all the unexpected twists and turns, but because of them. Chapter 18. Hoopocalypse. There was a saying that Joe and I always heard in tech startup circles. Be wrong as fast as you can. Its meaning was this. If some part of your project, or maybe even the whole thing, is going to fail, it's better to know sooner rather than later. That way, you don't pour time and energy into wild goose chases. I was trying to be wrong as quickly as I could with this writing career. The success or failure of this book project would let us know whether there was any hope of me having long-term paying work as an author. And we needed an answer on that sooner rather than later, because we had some big decisions to make. The baby was 4 months old, and we were now a family of six squeezed into a small space. Every day it seemed clearer that we couldn't stay in Austin and live a balanced, family-focused life without an extra source of income. Soon we would need a bigger house, in addition to various other expenses that come with a growing family. Joe simply didn't have that kind of income available to him in the Austin law market, at least not without ramping up into a high-pressure job. The options were clear. Make this writing career work, or pick up everything and move to a new city. Per our new baby tradition, we went into what we called bare minimum mode for the first 3 months after Kate was born. During this time, we didn't do anything ambitious, and we considered mopping the floor and cooking recipes with more than 5 ingredients ambitious. Bare minimum mode was all about consciously setting aside goals and plans so that we could rest, recover, and adjust to the new family size. But now, it was time to get back into regular life, and not surprisingly, I was finding it nearly impossible to get anything at all done. On the one hand, I was trying to bring God into the process beyond just ranting heavenward when things didn't go my way. My friend Anne continued to be a font of wisdom, and I looked forward to every note she sent, in part because each one radiated grace and love, and in part because I was baffled as to how she was able to keep up with her big book contract while homeschooling 6 kids, and I wanted to know her secret. Also, I just loved the way she wrote. Her last note contained the smile-inducing opening, "Just to offer a mixed bouquet of thoughts that I've plucked while cleaning up after lunch." She constantly encouraged me to trust that God would give me the time I needed. She told me to remember that this would all happen on His time frame, not mine. It sounded nice in theory, but I needed to make money. And in the past month, I'd only written 1.5 pages of text. "You want some help?" Hallie asked when I laid all of this out for her. "You're so sweet. No, thanks." "Seriously, Jen, I'm excited about what you're doing and would really like to help. Let me come over Friday. Dan is taking the day off from job hunting, so I could come watch your kids, do some cleaning for you, whatever you need." "That is such an awesome offer, but I really couldn't. It's fine. I'll figure something out." We were about to hang up since she and I both needed to start lunch when she interrupted our goodbyes. "You know, actually, can I be really honest with you for a sec?" This sounded ominous. Sure. "Do you think there's any chance that God is trying to show you how you might be able to get this project done, and you're not seeing it?" "What do you mean?" "I mean just now. I could easily give you a whole afternoon of writing time. I'm happy to. I want to. And you turned it down." There was no way I could let her come over. It was so hard for both of us to leave the house that, though we talked on the phone almost every day, Hallie hadn't been here in 3 months, maybe 4. She couldn't possibly be prepared for what a disaster it was, and she would undoubtedly start looking for a replacement friend as soon as she walked in the door. But I realized that if I turned down this offer of help, I couldn't complain about making no progress on the book this week, and I really wanted to preserve the option of complaining. "Okay, fine, but don't say I didn't warn you about the state my house is in," I said. I thought I detected a note of victory in Hallie's voice when she said, "I'll be there at noon." When Hallie arrived, the neighbor girls were standing on the porch with her, having shown up at the same time. I introduced everyone and said, "Girls, I would love for you to hang out today, but this is a big workday for me, so unfortunately I can't." A brief look of disappointment flashed across their faces. Now that school was out for the summer, they'd been coming by multiple times per week. We'd passed many afternoons lounging around the living room, them and my kids draped across the couch and the floor, chatting and watching shows. Carmen lit up with an idea. "Oh, can we help while you're working?" "That is so sweet, but..." Hallie jumped in. "Yes, what a kind offer. Miss Jen would love your help, girls. Come on in." Lucy was already down for a nap. I put the baby down for her nap, and the neighbor girls set up a game of Candyland with Donald and Lane on the kitchen table. Hallie started cleaning. It took every fiber of my being not to insist that she stop, but I forced myself to get to work as we'd planned. I hopped up the stairs to retrieve my laptop from my bedroom, and on the way, I ducked into the kids' bathroom to turn out a light. A sharp smell caught my attention, like a diaper in need of changing. Surely not. I looked toward the room where I'd just put Lucy down for a nap. She hadn't been making noise, which undoubtedly meant she was sound asleep, so I opened the door slowly to peek in. If I had had 1,000 years to prepare myself, I would not have been ready for what I saw. Lucy was wide awake, sitting up in her crib, a broad smile on her face. She looked like she'd been rolling around in a mud pit. But it wasn't mud. It was then that I remembered the number one truth of parenting. If you think you smelled poop, you did. My gaze drifted to the scene around her, my eyes glassy and moving slowly, like when people are in shock. Evidently, she had eaten something that didn't agree with her and tried to handle the resulting diaper accident herself. It looked like someone had hooked up a fire hose to a latrine and sprayed it around her corner of the room. The mess was everywhere. In her hair, ground into stuffed animal fur, smeared across toys, all over the pillow, and somehow also on the wall. I started shouting. My shouts didn't have any particular action item associated with them. I wasn't asking for assistance, since I knew I was on my own for this one. I wasn't mad at Lucy, since she was only 1 year old and her actions were a horrifically misguided attempt to help. It was just a loud, primal babbling of despair, peppered with gasps and mumbled profanity. I stepped forward to open the window to let the smell out, but stopped when I remembered the child safety locks that entombed us in this room. I started to pick Lucy up, then stopped when I considered my own clothes. In the end, I just stood there, frozen, feeling increasingly dizzy. I had come to the conclusion that the best course of action would be to curl up in a corner and cry until Joe got home, when Hallie walked in behind me. "Oh, my." The neighbor girls appeared from downstairs, followed by Donald and Lane. "Is that what I think it is? Oh, disgusting! The smell!" I silenced the voices behind me and told them in shaky words that they could return downstairs. Hallie left with them, but returned quickly with a dark-colored towel. "Wrap her in this to pick her up," she said in the tone of a military general announcing the battle plan. "I'll start the bath. You bring her right in." I did as I was told. Hallie left the bathroom just as I entered, and she returned with a trash bag. With the water filling the tub behind me, I peeled off Lucy's shirt and socks, dropping each item directly into the bag while Hallie held it. "Do you want to try to wash these?" she asked. The look I gave her didn't require words. These clothes could have been handmade and smuggled out of a war zone by my great-great-grandmother, and my first choice still would have been to incinerate them. I tossed the towel in the bag, too, and Hallie disappeared to throw it away. I plopped Lucy in the bath. As I slowly and pitifully went to work on her hair, I reminded myself to put hazmat suit at the top of my Christmas list this year. It took the better part of an hour to get her clean, and all the while I tried not to think of adjectives to describe the texture of the bathwater. I had to drain the tub, refill it, drain it again, and then clean it with bleach before the final wash. When I considered the disaster that awaited me in her room, the sheets, the toys, the caked stuffed animal fur, the carpet, I imagined politely asking everyone to please step outside and then burning down the house. When the bath was finished, Lucy went happily on her way, doing her backward army crawl down the stairs to play with her siblings. I prepared myself to face my fate. I pulled my hair into a ponytail and sucked in a breath. I was honestly worried about vomiting when I saw the mess, so when I stepped into the room, I closed my eyes. Then I opened them. It was clean. The whole room was clean. There were even fresh sheets on the crib. It was as if the whole thing had never happened, and it was all just the scatological nightmare of a deeply disturbed mind. I started shouting again, equally incoherent, but this time using a different choice of words. I hope you don't mind. I rinsed the sheets with the outside hose before I put them in the washer, Hallie called from the playroom, where she was currently organizing the toys. I put the water on extra hot. I stumbled over to her.
You cleaned all of that?
The stuffed animals took a little work, but I think they're good now. I set them on the back porch to dry. The toys are in bleach in the kitchen sink. My mind raced to come up with some way to express to her what this meant to me. Maybe I could offer free babysitting services for life? Serenade her with an a cappella version of Wind Beneath My Wings? Get a mural tattooed on my back that depicted her riding a unicorn? Stand outside her window with a huge boombox like the guy in Say Anything? I was open to any and all ideas. After the house settled down again, I finally cleared my mind enough to get to work on the book. As I started, a new emotion descended upon me. Sheer, utter mortification. This is exactly why I didn't want anyone's assistance. Whenever I turned down offers of help, I always justified it by thinking, I don't want anyone else to see my mess. Little did I know how valid that fear was. In the middle of elaborate planning to adopt a new identity and start our family's lives over in another country, a thought came to mind. Maybe this is what an answered prayer looks like. I had been complaining for weeks that I was struggling with everything I had on my plate, all the while turning down offers of help. Hallie had made this offer many times before, and I said no. The neighbor girls always said they'd be happy to watch the big kids if I wanted to sneak into my office, and I always demurred. I'd recently run into a woman at church who'd stumbled across my blog, was excited to read that I was writing a book, and offered to have a takeout dinner brought to our family to free up my time one evening. I responded with my mantra, "No, I couldn't possibly." I'd often wondered how my blogger friend Anne and others like her could balance things so well. Sometimes it seemed like they were secretly given an extra 12 hours in each day or magic powers that the rest of us were denied. But now I considered that maybe people like Anne were just more open to God moving in their lives in ways that took them outside of their comfort zones. Chapter 19. If You're Happy and You Know It. Many months later, the manuscript for the book was almost finished. It had taken me so much longer than I'd expected. Baby Kate was now over a year old. I'd first started working with Ted almost 2 years before. My progress had been hampered by a never-ending stream of interruptions that would have made the creativity gurus take me by the hand and say, "Maybe it's time to give up." But I was almost done, and I felt a rush of electric anticipation about moving on to the next step, and maybe even finding a publisher. I had a lot of strikes against me. Unpublished author, not well known, no experience in the industry. But Ted was a highly respected agent, and there was a real possibility he could open doors for me. Even if I got only rejections, at least we'd know. I had no illusions that I would become the next Dean Koontz, but there was a real possibility that I could at least bring in enough income from this project that it could relieve some of our financial pressures. Not only did we need a bigger house, but the old minivan we'd purchased when Lucy was born was now falling apart. The big problem was that the driver's side door broke. There was no way to open it. At 6 feet tall, with all of my height in my legs, It was an arduous process to scoot past the center console to exit the passenger side door, and I had a bulging purple bruise on my knee to prove it. So I'd started going through the window. On a recent evening, a neighbor actually stopped walking his dog and stared for the entire procedure of me climbing out of my minivan. It was not the fluid Dukes of Hazzard maneuver I'd imagined it to be, and in fact ended with me landing on one foot and hopping forward before I stumbled into the grass. The neighbor shook his head and resumed walking his dog. So we needed money for car repairs in addition to a bigger house. It was time to get this book finished. I let the kids watch egregious amounts of television and would return to them after a writing session with the guilty demeanor of a dog who'd chewed up a dress shoe. I got up too early. I stayed up too late. Yet, whenever I was writing, it didn't feel like work. A concerned commenter on my blog asked why I would want to undertake this project when I had my hands so full at home. The answer was that it was because I was so maxed out in my daily life that I needed this outlet. The process of writing didn't sap my energy. As is always the case with Blue Flames, this work gave me energy when I did it. I'd begun to hear other people talk about this phenomenon as well. Not in person, since I had basically no social life, but I'd heard about it on the internet. One blogger absolutely loved knitting. Another delighted in cooking. And yet another was into music. Another woman I followed had created a garden that was so vast and overflowing that it was as if she had a small farm in her backyard. All of our gifts were different. The gardener woman probably thought that hours of writing sounded like torture, and I had already decided that if the world food supply collapsed, I was just going to have to be one of the people who starved to death. But all of us agreed on one thing. This work did not drain us, but in fact filled us up. On a Tuesday morning, I clicked through a list of edits I'd made during my read-through, deleting a paragraph here, rewording a sentence there. I couldn't help but grin as I watched this project come together. I was proud of it. I'd worked hard, and I felt confident that I'd told this story to the best of my ability. I finished a page of edits and flipped to the next page, which was blank. There were no more edits. I was done. I wanted Hallie to read it and give me feedback, so I printed a copy and even picked up a decorative binder during a grocery trip. It had a mint-colored background with a delicate floral pattern printed in white, which added a touch of class to my work. I painstakingly three-hole-punched the pages in thin stacks, assembled them in the pretty binder, and even included a cover page, as if I were trying to impress my high school English teacher. At the end of the week, I packed up the kids to go to Hallie's house for a playdate and manuscript delivery trip. On the way over, I heard what sounded like water splashing in the back of the car. I thought my ears must be deceiving me since we didn't bring any drinks. Donnell enlightened me. "Lucy threw up!" "I throw up too," Lane said from her seat next to Lucy. Another stomach flu had been going around the area, and evidently it had just reached the Fulweiler minivan. I pulled up in front of Hallie's house and squeezed myself into the back of the vehicle, using an old roll of paper towels to get things cleaned up until we could get back home. Needless to say, there would be no playdate. I got back behind the wheel so I could get these plague-ridden kids to the house, where they could vomit all over the couch instead of the car. Just as the wheels rolled forward, I remembered the book. I rolled down the passenger window and tossed the decorative binder out onto the sidewalk. I'd aimed for a nice landing, but instead it splattered open, the pages fanning unevenly where the jaws of the binder coil had snapped. I called Hallie and told her that we were turning around and that she would find my beloved project scattered all over her sidewalk. Hallie loved the manuscript, and we both pretended to believe her many assertions that she was not at all biased by our friendship. After a quick read-through by Joe, I sent it to Ted. It was such an enormous moment that I took a picture of the email with the attachment and posted it on my blog. While I waited for his response, I watched Ted's Twitter posts obsessively, assuming that every update was secretly a commentary on my project. One day passed. Then two, then three. I could hardly contain my nervousness and excitement. He would probably want a few revisions, and then we'd begin the work of finding a publisher. I became giddy whenever I dared to imagine what the next few weeks would look like. When his response finally arrived, I was standing in the living room eating handfuls of sea salt and vinegar chips straight from the bag while the kids watched Barney. My laptop sat on its usual spot on top of the fireplace, and the new bolded item in my inbox caught my attention. I threw the chips in the general direction of the table and ran to the screen. Ted said he wanted me to call him. A cold sweat spread over my skin. I noticed that he didn't say he loved it. His tone did not seem to indicate that this call was necessary because there were too many good things to fit into one email. "It's ready to go" is not a statement that requires verbal communication. I fished my cell phone from my jeans pocket and dialed his number. I knew I was playing with fire by trying to do this now. Casual phone calls had ceased to be part of my normal life around the time Lucy was born. My conversations always got interrupted so that I ended up speaking sentences like, "I'd like to speak with your customer service about what is that on your face?" But for the moment, the kids were zoned out to Barney. Maybe this could work. I started the call with nervous chatter, then finally shut up and let Ted speak. He listed what he liked about the pages he'd read, and my sense of foreboding increased with every compliment. When he finished his summary of all the good stuff, he paused. "There's a but, isn't there?" I asked. "There's a but," Donald shouted from the couch, sending his sisters into fits of giggles. "Yes, there is," Ted said gravely. I would have replied that it sounds like there's a big but, but I was afraid the kids might explode with ecstasy. "It needs work." I noticed that he didn't say some work or just a teeny tiny itty bitty bit of work. Lane complained that she couldn't hear the TV and turned up the volume about 20 clicks. Barney was talking about words that describe your feelings. I noticed that fatalistic despair wasn't on the list. "How much work?" "A lot." Ted began to lay out the problems with the manuscript, and they were huge. Worse, he was right. Now that I saw the draft through his eyes, the flaws were so clear. I stepped backward into the kitchen to put distance between myself and the loud purple dinosaur who was clapping and jumping with carefree elation. "These changes that we're talking about here don't seem to be within the scope of a standard revision," I said. Ted agreed. "I mean," the words caught in my throat. I couldn't bring myself to say them. Barney's band started up, and the kids turned the volume louder. I was so disconnected from reality that I barely registered the noise or any awareness that I could do something about it, as if I were having this call in the middle of a thunderstorm. I raised my voice so he could hear me. "It sounds like we're talking about a rewrite, like starting this whole thing from scratch." "You're probably looking at something like that." I ended the call as politely and professionally as possible, then stumbled back into a kitchen chair. I stared ahead, frozen like a statue of a failed writer. In the background, Barney started singing "If You're Happy and You Know It." "Mommy, clap your hands," Lucy called from the living room. With all of my career dreams crashing down around me, I forced a smile for her. And when Barney and his dinosaur friends sung, "If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands," I clapped right on cue. Chapter 20. Bible Charades. If I worried that I was not a real writer after such a spectacular failure with the manuscript, I should have taken comfort in the fact that I could do writer drama with the best of them. I moped. I sighed dramatically when anything about the book came up. I listlessly pushed a plate of lasagna away at the dinner table. Then I caught a whiff of the meat sauce and had three helpings. Joe kept telling me to shake off the setback and get back to work. On the way to church the Sunday morning after the rejection, he said, "You're going to let one person's feedback bother you this much?" "Yes." I turned the radio on the back speakers so the kids wouldn't be exposed to their mother's hyperbolic pessimism, and wondered when minivan makers will finally start including a soundproof roll-up limousine window as a standard feature. It's more than one person's opinion. It's a top literary agent pointing out that the manuscript that I poured almost 2 years of my life into is an irretrievable disaster. Joe frowned at the road in front of him. Everyone has to work on their craft. Everyone, even people with God-given gifts. Michelangelo spent his entire young life studying under masters of the arts. You think you're better than Michelangelo that you can jump into the work you love and nail it on your first try? He had a good point. I ignored it so I could keep the tortured artist vibe going. Here's the other thing, I said. I don't have peace about jumping into a brand new draft of this book. This whole endeavor of trying to launch a writing career hadn't turned out the way I thought it would. Back when I said yes to Ted, on that summer day when Joe and I were standing in our front yard, I had this lofty idea about how the creation of a family and the creation of meaningful work were both ways of encountering God. I thought it would be a gift to myself and to my family to ignite my blue flame, and eventually, hopefully, bring in a little income from it. But now I see that I was wrong and I have no talent and I've wasted everyone's time. Joe shook his head in lieu of responding to my drama. So what's your plan now? He asked. Maybe I should look more seriously at going back to tech work. Or I could not work at all. It puts more pressure on you in terms of finances, but maybe it'd be better if I had more time for household stuff. I don't think you should give up on this dream, Joe said. I don't have peace with going back to writing right now. Do you have peace with walking away from it? A full mile of highway passed before I responded, no. After Mass, a woman stood up in front of the congregation and announced an upcoming women's retreat. She shared a moving testimonial about how her life had been transformed by it. She wasn't even finished with her speech before I elbowed Joe and whispered that I wanted to go. I hadn't been very involved in our church community because I was so maxed out at home, so this seemed like a perfect opportunity to rekindle my prayer life and maybe even meet some other women. I imagined spending all morning praying and reading scripture, then having quiet conversations with fellow retreatants over meals. 2 weeks later, I was waking up on a church bus as it pulled up to the retreat center, which was located in a rural area an hour outside of town. After I shook myself awake and gathered my backpack, I stepped out onto the gravel drive to find myself at an unmarked building. Farmland stretched to the horizon. The only sign of civilization was a dilapidated hayloft about a mile away. I felt disoriented, like the people in the TV shows who have been kidnapped and taken to the terrorist's bunker. The building contained a lofty auditorium space, which was flanked by a chapel, two sleeping quarters packed with bunk beds, and an industrial kitchen. The structure rumbled with thunderous sounds of commotion from inside. When the retreat leaders opened the doors, it was an explosion of light and sound. There was music. There were shouts of welcome. There were hand-decorated signs with glitter and streamers. The organizers all wore bright pink T-shirts whose vibrant hue matched their cheerful personalities. Women hopped off the bus behind me, rushing up to other women with hugs and squealed exclamations of greeting, giving the impression that pretty much everyone but me had come with a friend. In my rush to get away, I had not looked into the details of this weekend before I signed up. And that, it now occurred to me, was a grave error. In my defense, I had no idea that Catholics even did retreats like this. I had many evangelical friends. Again, friends meaning people I talked to on my computer from the shadowy recesses of my home, who described events at their churches as riotously fun gatherings where people sung and waved their hands and used the word fellowship as a verb. I had counted on my Catholic brethren to put together an emotionless, entirely cerebral retreat, and now it seemed that they had failed me completely. A woman ran up to greet me. Jennifer, welcome, sister. I forgot that I'd been handed a name tag back in the parking lot where I met the bus, and in my sleepy state, I was dazzled by her supernatural knowledge of my name. I was snapped awake, however, when she slipped my cell phone from my hand and dropped it into the wicker basket she held at her side. "I'll take that, honey. Have an amazing weekend." I turned to follow her, wondering if she was one of those pickpockets who you see on the news who's so confident that nobody ever reports them. Then I noticed other women gladly handing over their devices. Evidently, this was part of the retreat. With Joe and four little kids at home, the idea of not having access to my phone for the entire weekend made me feel shaky. I was about to chase down the woman who took it when another lady intercepted me and announced that we were about to start praise and worship. I didn't know if she was an organizer or another hostage or what, but I asked, "Do you have a copy of the schedule I can look at?" She beamed with excitement. "They don't give us schedules. It's all a surprise." I stood in the entryway of the retreat center, the sensory jumble of bright colors and happy sounds swirling all around me, the realization descending upon me with great force and speed that this wasn't the silent retreat I'd expected it to be. For an introvert who lived in a house with constant noise and unexpected interruptions, who desperately needed some quiet time to think and reflect, this was my personal version of Dante's Inferno. There was singing mixed with hand-holding, lively chatter in the dormitory late into the night, group leaders waking us up at dawn with loud, gleeful songs of praise. At one point, I was gently and lovingly dragged from the chapel where I'd been praying because it was time to participate in a dance competition set to Christian music. Even in the midst of it, I could see the goodness of the people there. The women who organized it did the entire thing on a volunteer basis, and they poured their souls into the event. The other attendees were friendly, open, and genuinely wanted to become better people through the weekend. If I weren't in a season of life when I was constantly overstimulated to begin with, even I might have enjoyed it. As it was, when the final event of the evening rolled around, I was a basket case. I had never had a true panic attack in my life, but I was pretty sure it was about to happen here. The combination of feeling mentally at my limit with not having a phone or a car made me feel raw and powerless in a way I had only rarely experienced before. Luckily, this final activity was what I'd been yearning for when I signed up for this retreat. A half a dozen priests from across the diocese were coming in, and each would be available for confession and spiritual counseling. As we gathered in the main hall beforehand, one of the organizers hushed the crowd for an announcement. "I'm afraid we have some bad news," she said. "Father George, whom many of you know, has had a tragedy happen in his family." She explained that just an hour before, Father George had received the news that both his niece and his nephew had been killed in a car accident. He would, of course, need to leave for the airport to be with his family, and now we'd be short a priest. We milled into lines accordingly, all of us stunned as we processed the news. Though I did not know this Father George, many of the women there did, and they were openly stricken on his behalf. The room took on a somber, prayerful tone. For the first time since we arrived, there was silence. Makeshift confessionals were set up throughout the building, one behind a screen on the stage at the front of the room, another just inside the kitchen. I got in line for the one in which the priest was stationed at the end of a long hall, mainly because it had the shortest line. When I took my seat, I was met with the kindly face of a man who appeared to be in his 50s. He put me at ease immediately. I couldn't place this priest's accent, but he reminded me of our friends from Mumbai, so I guessed he was from India. I made my confession, and then, afterwards, he asked what else was on my mind. "This is going to sound silly," I said, "but I'm struggling to figure out whether or not I should do some work that I love." I told him everything. I was one of the last people in line, and there was still plenty of time, so I went into detail about my situation. I told him about the call I'd felt to have a big family, despite the fact that I'd give myself a C- in parenting most days. I told him about how I yearned to build a writing career for my own fulfillment and also to help pay the bills. I told him about the rejection and how I'd have to start again at square one if this book were ever to be written. For the first time since I'd arrived, my body relaxed, the stress pouring out of me like a lance draining a wound. When I finished, he was quiet for a long moment. He rested his head on his clasped hands as if he were thinking or praying or both. Finally, he spoke. "Congratulations," he said. "I'm sorry?" "Congratulations. You said you're writing a book." "Oh, yes. Okay, thanks." "This must be exciting for your family." "I guess so. But that's the thing. I worry that it's not a good thing for the kids." "But have you brought them into it?" "In what way?" I tried to imagine what that would look like, but my mind stalled out with a vision of the last time I tried to write in the living room when Lane and Lucy took turns climbing on my head. "Are you thinking of all of this book, the other things that you do, are you thinking of it in terms of your family or in terms of yourself?" "I'm not sure I follow." "Remember this," he said. "Where there is no unity, there is no God. God is always calling us to connection, to unity. And if we don't have that, we are not walking with God." As he spoke, his face radiated joy, as if a light had been switched on inside of him. He was one of those people who's filled with an undefinable yet palpably present grace that makes you feel warm and safe. Yet I wasn't sure what his words, as wise as they were, had to do with my conundrum. Luckily, he elaborated. "Do this work that God is calling you to do, but do it as one part of something bigger, your family." His eyes shone with genuine concern. "Have you ever asked what work your family is supposed to do together?" "Well, no, I haven't." "We always think like individuals, like the work that we do has nothing to do with anyone else. God wants us to see what we do as just one small part of something greater. Like a symphony." I didn't mean to interrupt, but I finally understood what he was getting at, and the words escaped from my lips without me even realizing it. I imagined an orchestra belting out a Beethoven piece. Each member plays his or her own tune, but does it with the goal of creating something greater with others. "Yes, like that. Unite with your family. Bring them into what you do, and bring what you do into your family. Move in unity, not apart from one another." My mind was on high alert so that I could absorb every word he said. "My child, if you do this, you will find joy. More joy than you can imagine. Don't forget that." It was time for me to go, so he gave me a final blessing. Time seemed to stop as he whispered the words of prayer over me, and for that infinite moment, I felt nothing but peace. When I got back into the auditorium, I realized I never did catch his name. I looked over my shoulder at the handwritten note taped on a wall near the hallway, which said, "Father George." I pulled one of the organizers aside and asked if this was a different priest with the same name. She shook her head. "No, this is the Father George we mentioned earlier. His flight is later in the evening, so he came up here before he has to leave. Isn't he just darling?" I looked back toward the hallway, trying to process the fact that I had been speaking with the same priest who just found out that he lost multiple beloved family members. The organizer went on to tell me that he was from Pakistan and grew up in extreme poverty in a remote village where he was persecuted for his faith. I thanked her and wandered into the chapel, where I settled into a pew at the back. The door had been left open, and I heard a crescendo of voices just outside. I twisted around to see that Father George was leaving, and a group of women and other clergy had gathered around him to console him. And yet, to look only at body language, it appeared that he was consoling them. He moved easily and peacefully as he shook another priest's hand. His gaze was steady and welcoming when a woman who grabbed him by the hand spoke to him. I'd been reading the work of Thomas Merton, a world-traveling agnostic who left everything to become a monk. One of his lines I'd highlighted came to mind now. Love is our true destiny. We do not find the meaning of life by ourselves alone. We find it with another. We do not discover the secret of our lives merely by study and calculation in our own isolated meditations. The meaning of our life is a secret that has to be revealed to us in love. A wave of tears overflowed from deep within me, and I didn't even try to stop it. I simply sat, closed my eyes, and let myself sit with the gratitude and relief and exhaustion I felt in this moment. A warm hand touched mine, and one of the retreat leaders appeared at my side. She eased herself into the pew next to me and lovingly placed her arm around my shoulders. Then she leaned in close and whispered, "Jennifer, it's time to play Bible charades." Chapter 21, Tex-Mex Epiphany. I once saw a product on Amazon called the Relax Man. It's a white sleep capsule with vague resemblance to a spaceship in which you can enclose yourself to shut out the world completely, available for the bargain price of $85,995 plus $2,500 shipping. All throughout the extrovert retreat, I fantasized about having one of these fine items. I imagined waving at my fellow retreatants and shouting, "Y'all have fun," over their singing before I pressed the button to close the lid on my hermetically sealed tube. I figured that in order to recover, I would have to create a poor man's version of this product by wrapping myself in blankets, sliding on my largest headphones, and zoning out to TV or a book after the kids went to bed. Yet after my conversation with Father George, I was filled with a new energy that stayed with me through the rest of the retreat. When I got home, I charged into the house, scooping up the kids for hugs and kisses, and told Joe that I couldn't wait to talk. I felt like I'd been carrying around a wrapped gift, one that I could now tear open and unpack with him. That night, after the kids were asleep, we set wine glasses on the table between us, the logos of the wineries where we bought them almost entirely scrubbed away by too many runs through the dishwasher. Hand-washing wine glasses stopped being a thing in our house around child number two. I told Joe everything the kindly priest had said to me. As we contrasted Father George's advice to our current approach to work and life, we realized his suggestion wasn't just a minor tweak to the way we were doing things. It would involve a fundamental shift. Father George's words were the fruit of an entirely different worldview from that of the modern United States. Recalling that he was from Pakistan, I thought of the Pakistani babysitter who worked for us when Donald was a baby. I remembered being confused by the choices that she and folks in her circles made. She mentioned a cousin who passed up a prestigious job opportunity to stay close to his elderly parents. She got her extended family's input on a big school decision she had to make. Because I'd always been steeped in a worldview in which personal autonomy is seen as the primary path to happiness, these kinds of decisions struck me as a recipe for dissatisfaction. What if she didn't like her family's input? What if her cousin never got another cool job opportunity? It now dawned on me that these choices were born out of an entirely different set of convictions about what really leads to fulfillment in life. Joe pointed out that many of our friends from other countries and cultures saw interdependence on family as a natural part of life. Just the week before, a family friend had taken off days of much-needed work to help an ailing brother back in Mexico. It never occurred to her not to go to him, even though taking the time off meant she would now struggle to pay her bills. Other family members came together to help her help him, pooling their funds to assist her in covering rent that month. The way they saw it, you make time for your work as it fits into your family. You don't make time for your family as it fits into your work. Until this conversation, I had never realized just how different my own view was. Now, I thought for the first time, what if there's another way to see this? As a result of that conversation, we decided to come up with a family vision. Joe and I had spent most of our adult lives laying out detailed plans for personal achievements. Now, we realized that we had never done the same thing for our family. To borrow from the analogy in the conversation with Father George, we'd been planning our lives as if we were a group of soloists, all of us playing our own tunes on the same stage. Now, we wanted to see what kind of symphony we could create if we started thinking like an orchestra. My mom volunteered to babysit that Saturday night so we could go out to dinner, and we headed to our favorite Tex-Mex spot, located in a shopping center that was nestled into a wide network of neighborhoods near our house. We settled into a table on the outdoor patio, the chips and salsa arriving before we finished scooting in our chairs. Under the protective spread of an old cedar elm, with the precise, colorful notes of a Spanish guitar album in the background, we set out to dream about what our ideal version of family life would look like. We laid a notebook open on the table that we'd pulled from the kids' art supplies just before we left the house. What are three words that would describe our ideal family culture? Joe asked. He wrote the same question at the top of the page. After a discussion so lively that the waiter approached but walked away twice, we came up with creative, entrepreneurial, and Christian. It wasn't a perfect list, and we knew that we'd probably end up tweaking these adjectives or even replacing them altogether. But even having this rudimentary set of words to key off of instantly shifted the way I thought about our family's life. We started a new page, and I wrote the three words in all caps at the center. I slid the notebook back in between the two of us, and we asked ourselves, if someone were to observe our family for a day, would they come up with these words? It had been a particularly rough afternoon, with none of the kids sleeping well the night before and a variety of messy disasters occurring, so I noted that this was a bad time to ask that question. If someone had seen our house today, they would have handed back a list that said, warlike, loud, and sticky. Nonetheless, it was a fascinating exercise to take a look at how we conducted ourselves on a daily basis and see how well we were actually putting these ideals into practice. The discussion also left me feeling lightened by a new and unexpected sense of freedom. As Joe and I talked about the entrepreneurial adjective, we discussed how we were the kind of family that enjoyed testing out new technology. Thanks to our tech backgrounds, he and I were early adopters of things like e-readers, social media, blogging, and smart home devices. We'd begun looking into how apps might help us with education, and Donald was already talking about learning to write code. When I articulated this facet of our family's collective personality, I could accept certain areas in which we might have different standards than other people. For example, we would always do more screen time than other families who weren't as into technology as we were. I also started to let go of my obsession with other lifestyles that were alluring for various reasons, but weren't ultimately a good fit for us. Just that morning, I'd read a blog post by a mom who described her family's lifestyle as intellectual crunchy. They lived on 10 acres of land with a sprawling garden that was managed entirely by the kids, who spent most of their days outdoors. They even had a goat whose milk they used to make cheese and handcrafted cakes of soap. Each night, one of the parents read aloud from a classic work of literature while the kids washed vegetables from the garden. When I saw this over my morning cup of coffee, I was rocked by the usual wave of insecurity panic that made me want to spit out my drink, throw our TV into the Goodwill dumpster, and return to the house with a goat under one arm and a volume of Virgil's major works under the other. But now, I was taking the first steps toward a place where I could appreciate other families' ways of doing things without falling into guilt or comparison. With a plate of steak nachos in front of us and an easy breeze that hinted at the cooler fall weather to come, we filled up 6 more pages of notes and ideas. We asked questions like, what would our perfect day look like? And how can we have a cohesive family culture where individual talents shine as well? And covered pages with our answers. But the biggest revelation came at the very end of the discussion. Joe suggested that we do an inventory of our challenges and our blessings. We didn't have much of an extended family support network, with Joe, me, and my dad being only children, Yaya being estranged from her family, and my mom's siblings living thousands of miles away. However, we had a tremendous resource in our parents. My mom was only a couple of miles away. Yaya visited often and had been talking about moving nearby if we were going to stay here over the long term. My dad mentioned that he planned to retire in this area as well. And Papa lived just 10 miles up the road, which allowed our kids to have a close connection with their great-grandfather. We both shook our heads in awed gratitude. We're so lucky to have all of this, Joe said. We'd be crazy to throw it away. I knew exactly what he meant. Earlier in the conversation, we'd once again touched on the subject of moving. As part of Joe's continuing research on this subject, he'd identified a part of the state we could relocate to where housing prices were cheaper and his income would be higher for the same amount of work. Moving there would instantly resolve most of the financial crunch we were feeling. And now, once and for all, we took that option off the table. We talked about how that same opportunity could be the perfect answer for a different family. Hallie and Dan had recently asked similar questions, and they'd decided that the best path for them was going to involve moving out of Austin, then probably moving again after that. I smiled when I thought of Joe's friend from law school, who ended up buying an RV and traveling full-time with his wife and their 3 young children. Each of these families had an entirely different set of advantages and disadvantages to work with and had crafted lifestyles that smoothed over their challenges and maximized their blessings. Now, finally, we were doing the same. We agreed that we wouldn't speak of moving anymore. This created new pressures. Joe estimated that we could scrape by another year on just his income. But that was about it. In 12 to 18 months, something would have to give. But we would think about all of that later. When we left the restaurant, I paused at the gate of the patio to take in the moment. A slight chill had swept into the night air, and it seemed to hint at fresh starts. This vision we were concocting for our family was still vague, but I had no question that we were on the right path now. I jogged to catch up with Joe, the notebook clutched to my side, filled with that same mix of feeling daunted and excited as when you're at the top of a big hill on a roller coaster and you're just about to go over the other side. Chapter 22, Banana Man. I had not yet started rewriting the book, though this time it wasn't because I was being a drama queen. I wanted to continue fleshing out these new ideas about work and family life, and Donald was starting school. I was okay with hitting the pause button on my own work, even though money worries always lingered in the back of my mind. In the symphony that we were starting to play, it was my turn to put down my instrument. Donald was attending kindergarten at a local public charter school. I was climbing the learning curve of being a school mom, absorbing valuable lessons like the importance of being the first to make a food commitment for class potluck parties. As soon as I saw a sign-up list, I'd elbow aside other parents to get my name next to an item, because the lists all looked something like this. 2 bags of baby carrots, 3 loaves of bread, 3 bags of potato chips, 1 bunch of green grapes, 1 dozen gluten-free, sugar-free, dairy-free cupcakes, each decorated to represent a different character from Moby Dick. And if you're the last one to sign up, you know which one you're going to get. Meanwhile, Lane and Lucy were attending the church Mother's Day Out program 2 mornings per week. With all the school drop-offs and pickups, I was starting to consider the car my second home. Halloween fell on a Sunday, and I noticed that morning at church that I felt a pinching in my right leg whenever I stood. This was the leg that had the blood clot when I was pregnant with Lane, and it had sustained permanent damage. That ankle was purple with a spray of broken blood vessels, and that calf was an inch wider in circumference than the other one, bulging with varicose veins. Normally, the leg didn't bother me aside from how it looked. However, in early pregnancy, I always felt a pain in the spot where I'd had the clot. It went away as soon as I began doing the blood thinner shots, but it was one of the reasons I'd suspected I was pregnant the last 2 times around. And now, the pain was back. My first chance to take a test came after Joe got home and my mom arrived to help get the kids into their costumes. I grabbed cans of glitter hairspray and pastel face paint to turn Lane and Lucy into princesses, and Donald pulled on his skeleton costume. Kate was being helped into her tiger outfit by my mom. When everyone was set, I excused myself to go put on my own costume and snuck upstairs to take a test. Immediately, there were 2 lines. Baby number 5 was on the way. When he or she was born, we'd have 5 kids under age 7. It didn't seem like the perfect time for a baby to come along, but it never did. I always felt like we could have a little more money, more space in the house, or more things accomplished without the demands of a newborn. I was starting to recognize that it always feels problematic to fit another child into your family when you're contemplating pregnancy. Yet when that child arrives, his or her life is instantly intertwined with yours in a way that feels so right that it's as if there were never a possibility of this person not existing. The minute you see that baby, the whole universe retroactively adjusts itself so that this life was meant to exist all along. My mom called to me from downstairs, so I tossed the test in the trash. I grabbed a keyboard to complete my costume, writer, which was not going to win me any creativity awards, and hurried to rejoin the group. My dad had just arrived to take pictures, and Joe was putting the finishing touches on his own outfit. A year before, Joe and I had been surfing the web together, a laptop sitting half on my lap, half on his, when we stumbled across a picture of a man wearing a banana costume. I laughed and was about to click away, but Joe stopped me. He was captivated by this masterpiece and announced that he must own it. "Halloween's a long way away," I said at the time. "What does that have to do with anything?" "It's a costume. Where else would you wear it?" Joe pitied my lack of vision. He proclaimed that the correct question for this outfit was not, "Where would you wear it?" but rather, "Where wouldn't you wear it?" I surprised him with it as a Christmas present, and he was more excited than the kids were when Santa brought them a rocking horse. When we were first dating, I'd noticed how proud Joe was of his custom tuxedo, which he'd special ordered from an exclusive tailor in Hong Kong when he graduated from business school. He bemoaned the fact that there weren't more opportunities naturally suited for such a magnificent outfit, and he promised to don it as often as possible, even if it made people uncomfortable. Now, he spoke the same way about the banana suit. Our crew headed out for trick-or-treating, the gentleman banana leading the way, with 2 princesses, a skeleton, a tiger, and a rider trailing behind. My mom picked up Kate, the confused tiger, while directing the skeleton, and my dad held the 2 princesses' hands. I pulled Joe back so we could talk. "Remember when I told you a few days ago I thought I might be pregnant?" Joe stopped and turned to me. "Oh my gosh, are you?" "Yep." He reached out to hug me, but I couldn't quite get my arms around the unwieldy costume, so we ended up patting each other on the hands. I put my finger to my lips to signal that I didn't want others to hear just yet. "So, how do you feel about this?" I asked. "I want to wait until I know how you feel. I'll be devastated or excited or whatever you want me to be." I laughed. "I'm really okay with it. I'm kind of starting to see that it never feels like a perfect time to have another kid, you know?" We watched our little crew run up to the door of a neighbor's house. Lucy shouted, "Gimme candy!" and we could hear Donald's murmured voice correcting her Halloween etiquette. Joe was lost in thought. "Wow, that's a lot of little kids in one house." We walked for a few more moments in silence. Now that Kate, who was 1.5, had had her first experience of getting chocolates and lollipops dumped into a bag by strangers, she got the concept and got it well. She shoved her siblings and grandparents aside as she toddled determinedly to the next house, holding her bag out in front of her in case any passerbys wanted to throw in more goodies as well. As we rounded a corner, Joe seemed to have come to a big conclusion that he wanted to announce. I assumed that he was going to share a new strategy for how we